Mark chapter 13, verses 1 to 13. As he came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what large stones and what large buildings." Then Jesus answered him, "Do you see these great buildings? Not one stone will be left here upon the other. All will be thrown down." When he was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will this be? And what will be the sign that all these things are about to be accomplished?" Then Jesus began to say to them, "Beware that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name and say, 'I am he,' and they will lead many astray. When you hear of wars and rumours of wars, do not be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is still to come. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. This is but the beginning of the birth pangs. As for yourselves, beware, for they will hand you over to councils, and you will be beaten in synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings because of me, as a testimony to them. And the good news must first be proclaimed to all nations. When they bring you to trial and hand you over, do not worry beforehand about what you are to say, but say whatever is given to you at the time, for it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise against parents and have them put to death. And you will be hated by all because of my name. But the one who endures to the end will be saved."
Thank you, Phil. Last Sunday morning, at 10:30, many of us gathered from the congregation in the public just down the road, just opposite the train station, at Hookie Park for the annual Remembrance Day service. And this was a particularly special one because it was the centenary of Armistice. It was held at Hookie Park, and 100 years ago, on Sunday, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, after 4 years of quite brutal battle in World War I, when hundreds of thousands of people were killed, an agreement was signed to cease fighting on the Western Front. And this slide I'm showing you shows retired Major Kenneth McKenzie, who was speaking at the service on Sunday. And you can see Randall in the background as well, if you notice, if you can see him from the picture there, he was the MC. The world, after witnessing the horrors of World War I, when they heard about the armistice, which means putting down weapons, they just broke out into this celebration. They knew that after 4 years, over 4 years of fighting, that there was going to be a peace and some agreement was made. Now, the armistice is just a cessation of hostilities, putting down weapons, and a surrender came after that. But the armistice meant that something was happening, that the war had come to an end. And there was quite a lot of celebrations. And even hear about the news in Australia, when people heard about it, how people started going out onto the street and just celebrating. And traditionally, on this day, as I did on Sunday, people wear a poppy. Now, this is a woolen one. It's made by some volunteers, and you pay a bit of money for it, and it puts money towards people, return service people. And a poppy is worn on Remembrance Day or Armistice Day, and it's inspired by the World War I poem, which is titled In Flanders Fields. It's in the opening line, in the poem it talks about poppies, and it talks about this because poppies were the first flowers to grow after the war ended, after the ground was churned up, where soldiers' graves lie, poppies started coming out of the ground. And so in remembrance of World War I, people wear poppies. And during the day, people were able to lay some poppies, paper ones, in Hooky Park, near the memorial there. I'll come back to that later. So I'd like to read out this poem to you. It's written by John McCrae, and it goes like this. In Flanders fields the poppies blow, between the crosses row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the larks bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead short days ago. We lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw. The torch be yours to hold it high, if ye break faith with us who die. We shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. It's just a lovely poem, and I often am quite touched by the way artists go into war areas and write poetry or do artwork to capture some of the sense of what was going on. So this, on Remembrance Day, it's remembered as a time of relief, when the world could stop warring, a time to grieve, a time to bury the dead, a time to rebuild, and a time to work towards peace. And also remind ourselves of the futility of war and how destructive and how unnecessary it is. I must say, it felt quite a bit weird. I don't know if weird is the right word, but it was a contrast. It was a lovely day on Sunday, if you remember the day. It was sunny. There was not a breeze in the sky. It was no clouds either. It was just a perfect spring day. And it couldn't have been a more perfect day. And I got to the service, and a few of others of you there were there as well. We had Steve at the sound desk. And I had my beautiful son sitting down on my lap as I sat on the grass, as we looked at the ceremony take place. An ex-serviceman sitting behind us, he had a sausage dog. Now, I don't know if it's called a sausage dog, but anyway, this little dog came up and wanted a bit of my son's sandwiches. I could hear kids playing in the park in the background. And if you know Hooky Park, you got the memorial section there, then the person who took the photo behind them is the playground. And you could hear kids playing in the background. You could smell the waft of sausages being cooked on the barbecue by the Lions, Moorabark Lions Club, and the chatter of about 200 people or so. The chatter and the noise of people simply listening in silence, people in the background talking and just taking in the service. There's this contrast, the peacefulness of where we were and what we were looking at, what we were hearing and talking about. If it wasn't for the words read out by General Mackenzie, the poem, the Flanders, which I read out for you, or the stories that were read out as well of various other people, you could be forgiven for thinking that conflict and war is simply a fantasy. We weren't really touched by it on that day. Maybe it's too far away to be of consequence on that beautiful day as we remembered these stories. Although I'm a family of World War II refugees, I haven't experienced firsthand anything of a war like my grandparents or my dad. And it's easy, particularly if of my generation, and Australians and younger than me, it's particularly easy to think that peaceful situations are quite normal. We haven't had a war in Australia for being affected by one as such as big as World War I and World War II for many years. So, without being aware of world events all the time, Remembrance Day, it's very easy to forget these sorts of things and the hostility of the world that we live in, the conflict that is all around us. And as we're at the Remembrance Day service on Sunday, it's just great to have a sense of history, a sense of what has gone before us, even though we're not affected by it, but actually entering into the stories that have been told. And I realise this sharpens my awareness. It makes me more aware of what's happened before us and gives me a bit more context of our nation. And even when I talked to my grandparents, when I did talk to them, it gave me awareness of what part of my story is as well and what they went through as they escaped their homeland. But I must say, sometimes it leaves me a bit weary too, being married to an ex-service woman, Sandra being in the RAF band, also AAAF band, sorry Phil. You hear about lots of war stories and you can become a bit overcome by them. And I don't know if you listen to stories on Anzac Day or watch the TV, you can feel a bit weary or a bit overcome by the amount of conflict and sadness that happens as we commemorate these times. And I believe this is why Mark 13 is a good chapter of the Bible to get into. I find Mark 13 quite helpful. It's a chapter in Mark's gospel that puts the disciples also into a bigger historical perspective. Jesus is opening up their eyes to stuff, in their case, that will happen. In our case, when we come together for Remembrance Day, we're thinking about stuff that has happened. And nonetheless, it brings us into a bigger story. It brings us into a larger narrative of what's gone before us and what will happen. And Jesus, as he brings their realization into this bigger picture, this larger conflict around them, he's sharpening their faith, I believe. He's preparing them. And instead of making them afraid, he gives them a way to respond as he goes through the conversation in Mark chapter 13, and also gives them hope as well. So things that might seem earth-shattering to them, these end-time events, at least for them, it might be overwhelming, but the way that Jesus approaches it gives them a way to respond and teaches them how to have hope. So I'd like to go through the chapter of Mark 13 as we look through this. Now, a bit of a historical context before we launch into it. It's likely that Mark wrote this gospel about AD 66 to 69, so 40 years after Jesus. And if you know a bit of history about that time in the Roman Empire, the Christians, particularly in Rome, were under quite a lot of persecution. Mark, who wrote this gospel, wrote it and likely sent it to churches in Italy, and particularly the house churches in Rome as well, where in AD 64, the city of Rome had been burned accidentally, but the fire had spread, and Emperor Nero blamed the Christians for it. And mentioning the name Emperor Nero, you probably realise some of the things that he did to the Christians as well. Peter and Paul, also the disciple Peter and the apostle Paul, had been martyred in Rome sometime around AD 64 to 68. And so when Mark wrote this gospel, chapter 13 would have been quite something they would have listened to and taken in, because the Christians were in quite a perilous situation. And then, of course, in AD 70, which Phil touched on in the Mark 13 reading, the prediction that Jesus makes of the temple being destroyed actually happens. And so this document, Mark, the Gospel of Mark, is given to a community in a time of crisis. And that's a good thing to remember. It's given to a community, to a group of people, in a time when things were quite perilous. And so it's there to encourage them and give them a framework to how to see things. So the chapter starts out in verse 1. I'd just like to reread verse 1 for us. Jesus has told the disciples three times that he's going to Jerusalem to die. They don't believe him. They don't believe that the Messiah is going to suffer and die. So Jesus realised what he's entering into as we read this story. And it starts out with Jesus knowing there's going to be conflict he's going to enter into, but then he talks about this greater conflict that's going to happen as well, and just making the disciples aware of it. And it starts out with a conversation. Mark 13, verse 1. As Jesus was leaving for the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what massive stones and what magnificent buildings." So they're looking at the temple, and it would have been quite magnificent. The artwork, the temple, the site as well. It was quite a big site where the temple lay, and it was quite a magnificent structure. It was the centre of the nation of Israel, both politically, religiously. It was the centre of what they're up to. And so the disciples see this big building and say, "Wow, isn't it quite magnificent? Isn't it grand?" Verse 2, Jesus replies, "Do you see all these things? Do you see all these buildings?" Jesus replied, "Not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down." Oh, the disciples would be thinking, how is that all going to happen? Jesus is making them aware of the conditions that they're living in, and the conditions of following him, that this society around them will be in conflict with them, following Jesus, in conflict with the Jewish system as well. So they're admiring this temple, they're admiring the permanence of it, but Jesus says, well, it's not so. It's all going to fall down. Israel will come under God's judgment because they rejected the Messiah. Jesus sort of is predicting that. And the temple will be destroyed. And for them, this is like an end time event. This is going to be, for them, if the temple is destroyed, this is like the end of history. This is the end of time. This is how they're thinking about things. And then the disciples do exactly what Christians through centuries have tended to do when thinking about end time events, which is, when? When is the end coming? How can we tell this? Verse 3. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James and John and Andrew asked him privately, "Tell us, when will these things happen and what will be the sign that they are all about to be fulfilled?" Now, Jesus doesn't answer them. He actually ignores their question and instead says something else to prepare for them. He wants to tell them something to make their faith sharp and aware, and to tell them about the conditions of where their faith is going to grow, and that they may not be aware of everything, they may not understand, but at least he's preparing them for something. And so rather than sending them into panic and into fear, he tells them a few things, and interesting what he tells them. In verses 5 to 6, the first thing that he tells them is to get busy, and get busy developing a spirit of discernment. Verse 5, Jesus said to them, "Watch out that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name, claiming I am he, and will deceive many." So the first thing that Jesus tells them about is to pay careful attention to what's going on. You're in a society, you're in a a culture of conflict. If you're going to follow me, there's going to be some conflict and there's going to be false things happening. And he says, don't be deceived because there's going to be false teachers around. They claim to have the words of Christ. Maybe they use religious language. Maybe they embellish their words with religious lace. He says, okay, be aware of it. There's going to be a time of conflict, and not everything with a Jesus label will be of me. And so he's making them aware of something that's going to happen going on. He's saying, have this discernment of what's going on. He next tells them to be patient. Verses 7 to 8. When you hear of wars and rumours of wars, do not be alarmed. Such things must happen. But the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places and famines. These are the beginning of birth pains. Now remember who this gospel was sent to the people in Rome in the house churches, where things were quite perilous for them. So they would have read this with quite a bit of sharpness. Jesus says to them, watch out for events going on. And I don't know whether watch is the best word. Maybe be aware. Be aware of what's going on around you. People are going to be likely confused. And notice what Jesus says. Verse 7, don't be alarmed. Don't be alarmed. Things are going to happen, but don't be alarmed. Despite these ominous signs all around, don't be overly concerned with what's happening. Certainly, don't try to cobble together speculative timelines of events and what's going to happen. Just be aware. Watch it. But don't be alarmed. What Jesus is saying is that church, in this patient outlook, is to have the long view towards things. To be patient in the midst of ominous signs, and to have this long view. And simply letting things roll out instead of trying to work stuff out. Don't be alarmed, he says. And then Jesus tells the disciples of what might happen to them in a more of a personal sense. And he's telling them in this next section to be faithful witnesses. Verses 9 to 11. You must be on your guard. You'll be handed over to the local councils, flogged in the synagogues. On account of me, you will stand before governors and kings as witnesses to them. And the gospel must first be preached to all nations. Whenever you are arrested and brought to trial, do not worry beforehand about what you say. Just say whatever is given to you at the time, for it is not you speaking, but the Holy Spirit. So he's telling them, with all this going on, instead of fear and speculating, he's telling them this is an opportunity to witness, to continue to live out this life of following Christ, to be a witness to his life and be part of this community, to live out their faith despite the troubles around them. It's quite encouraging. Now, I don't know whether the disciples would have remembered this. Maybe they would have heard about the conversation later on. But Jesus is implanting some ways to respond after his death, looking towards the temple being destroyed in AD 70. Then in verses 12 and 13, talks about how the breakdown of the closest ties will occur. Brother will betray brother to death, verse 12, and father his child. Children will rebel against their parents and have them put to death. Everyone will hate you because of me, but those who stand firm to the end will be saved. So with the destruction of the temple in view, with the judgment of Israel and Judea happening, Jesus also says that the family structures will break down as well because people believe in me. People won't like you because you follow Christ. He's making them aware of this. It's not unusual for that to happen, he's saying. And yet, because of their faithful endurance, they'll be saved. Now, it's not if you get through this, then you will be saved. We know that salvation is a gift. It's a gift that God gives us. But he's saying to these people that even through the most challenging times, they will experience the reality of Christ's life with them, their salvation, both now and then the fullness of the future. So he's telling them to just be aware of this sort of stuff going on, but remain faithful. Keep being faithful witnesses to me. Now, the chapter continues. Phil didn't read this one out. It continues in verses 14 and down to 22. It talks about, I won't read it out, but it talks about the abomination that causes desolation. Jesus is using this coded language, maybe referring to the Roman army being planted in Jerusalem and taking down the temple. And then there's other warnings in verse 2 about false messiahs as well. Verse 22 talks about the tactics of these deceivers who come in Jesus' name. They use these miracles and signs, being quite impressive. And Jesus says, don't be hoodwinked. Maybe that's a reason why Jesus didn't do too many miracles. He used them only sparingly in his ministry. So all of chapter 13 to this point is usually thought of talking about the disciples' generation in their time, fitting into the time around AD 70 when the temple will be destroyed. It goes down into verse 24 to 27, and some see here a shift in perspective of actually talking about times that might be our future. It talks about the sun and moon being darkened. It talks about heavenly bodies falling from the sky. It talks about the Son of Man coming in the clouds. And some view these verses referring to what will happen at the very end of history, the very end of the age. However, others see these verses continuing the address to the disciples and to those in Rome, talking about these events around AD 70, when Rome came in and razed the temple. The Bible often uses imagery of sun and moon and stars referring to earthly powers or governments which are falling. And this coded language continues. You have to think about what this document is written to. It's written to people in Rome. And if it's talking about Rome directly, then the book will be taken away. But when this coded language is used, you can understand what's being said to the community in Rome. So as we listen in to Jesus telling his disciples this, how does this passage keep us sharp and aware of our faith? I think the same message as to the disciples is for us as well. That is, no matter what perilous times we have or times of conflict that we live in, we continue to be discerning about what we're listening to. Have a discerning spirit, realising that everything it talks about Jesus is from him. Also continuing being a faithful witness to Christ in all of that. And also, don't be alarmed. Jesus says, don't be alarmed about this. This sort of stuff must happen. So Jesus is using this language, and sometimes coded, intended, not to mystify, but to reveal. And not to send Jesus' followers off onto a wild goose chase, but to give them something how to live and how to live in these times. So I find this passage very encouraging, particularly after Remembrance Day, when there's talk about wars, when there's commemoration about wars. And this comes to the other point I want to make. Although Mark 13 might seem quite ominous and unsettling, I think it also gives us a lot of hope as well. Going to the Remembrance Day service on Sunday when the grass was green and the sausages were smelling lovely, and the line was too big to actually get a sausage, so I had to go home. But I was being reminded about the historical world events and our place in them and how we came to be here. And I think that's important. When we read Mark 13, there's a biblical encouragement for us to enter into the history around us. I'm quite encouraged with the increase of interest around Anzac Day in our nation. More people are attending Anzac Day services in April. More people are being aware of the stories. As we look at Mark 13, I think Jesus is telling us to do the same. Be aware of history. Be aware of what's going on, of our place in it. Because Jesus says that history isn't just something that God sort of has to put up with and happens to happen. History is something, is a strategy that God is using for salvation. And that's a big statement to make, isn't it? That history is at God's, God is sovereign over all that goes on. Which is why Mark 13 is so good. Because Christ says the things that happen in the world, the things that we see going on, aren't just off to the side somewhere. It's part of God's big plan. And in fact, Jesus doesn't totally ignore history, or God doesn't totally ignore history at all, because he actually came in history to be with us. If we go to John 1, we see here that God chose to reveal himself in history and to be amongst us. John 1, verse 1, in the beginning, the Word... In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him not one thing came into being. In him, verse 4, was life, and the life was the light of all people. And then down in John 1, verse 14, and the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. So we know history just isn't a separate thing that happens and God happens to put up with it. He is involved with it. He's in it. He says history and the world events matter. We know that Jesus does eventually ask the question of the disciples. The disciples want to know when. And in verse 30, he says that, he says, truly I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. So he's saying to the disciples, what happens matters, and be aware of this sort of stuff. And he's also saying to us that God is up to something. History is going somewhere. And we can be assured that he has everything in his hand. He came into a time, he came into a place, he came into Galilee, walked amongst people. He's saying that history matters. And although that we live in a world of conflict, it's not something that is out of control. This is God's way, his strategy of letting salvation be known to the whole world. And so we need not worry about it. We need not be alarmed. God is working things out. And as he does that, our task is to be discerning, to be continue to be faithful witnesses and not be alarmed about what's going on. It's quite an encouraging chapter. I've often read Mark 13 and said that's pretty difficult. But in the context of these ceremonies that we have, it's encouraging. And we can be assured that there is an end point to history. Just in a few weeks' time, we're going to enter into the season of Advent, the Christian season of Advent, when we talk about and discuss the Jesus coming, things starting. But history also has an end as well. It's not just a circular thing of things going round and round and round. There's a point to history, an end point. And we can read this in Revelation in the last bit of the Bible, where we realise that history does have a purpose, God is revealed in history, and that it does have a destination. And it's a destination that gives us hope and a destination that we can look forward to. Revelation 21. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them as their God. They will be his peoples. And God himself will be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away." Every time I go to an Anzac service, Anzac Day service, or a Remembrance Day service, I think of these words and how God has entered into history and he's bringing it towards a completion and something that we can look forward to.